This is the president's FY 2018 budget.
And from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Colin Risdahl. It is Tuesday, the 23rd of May. Glad you could be here, everybody. That was Mick Mulvaney right after the gong back there, the director of the Office of Management and Budget, rolling out the Trump administration's FY 18 spending plan this morning.
The name on the cover is the new foundation for American greatness.
It is just as with the Trump administration itself, unlike many or really most other White House budget proposals.
We're no longer going to measure compassion by the number of programs or the number of people on those programs, but by the number of people we help get off of those programs.
Underlying the whole thing, underlying the entire Trump economic agenda, really is this idea.
The focus is sustained 3% economic growth. We have been attacked stunningly by some folks on the left and even in the mainstream who say that that's an unreasonable assumption.
And Mulvaney is not having it.
The 1.9% growth rates that the previous administration assumed towards the end of their administration and the 1.9% growth rates for the entire 10-year window that the CBO growth rates the Congressional Budget Office assumes, are something we simply reject.
Which is, of course, their prerogative. But on the continuing theory that economic facts matter, I'm obliged to point out here that in 2016, the U.S. economy grew at an annual rate of 1.6%, which is not 3%. Here's Mulvaney on the growth gap.
The differences between 2% growth and 3% growth doesn't sound like much. In fact, I cringe when I hear people say it's only a 1% difference. It's not. It's a 50% difference, but that's just math.
Or if you put it another way, the economy has to grow more than 50% faster to reach the target growth that makes this budget plan work. So now on to the bigger picture, which is this. Most candidates for the White House campaign on an economic agenda, a coherent strategy of how much to spend or not spend and what to spend or not spend it on. And theoretically, the big economic priorities for this White House, tax cuts and health care, should be reflected in the budget. We called Aparna Mathur. She's a resident scholar in economic policy at the American Enterprise Institute to see whether she thinks it is.
The tax cuts and the deregulation is assumed to lead to high economic growth rates. But we know, you know, what's happening right now in the White House. We don't even know what tax reform means currently. You know, is this something that will actually pass through Congress? So to have a budget that's sort of predicated on the health reform, the tax reform that they're talking about, and to imagine that all of this would actually take place, just seems really undefined to me at this moment.
Jay Shambaugh, just to round it out, teaches at George Washington University. He was on the Council of Economic Advisors for President Obama.
The cost of the tax cuts isn't in the budget at all, because they at no point have come to a kind of the specific detailed proposal that you would need to actually cost it out. They haven't said exactly where the numbers will break.
So on that theme, where the numbers are breaking, getting back to what Mick Mulvaney said about this budget and math, Marketplace's Sabri Benishore unpacks some of the other budgetary assumptions here.
President Trump's budget promises a lot.
He says he's going to significantly cut taxes and balance the budget in 10 years.
Howard Gleckman is with the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center.
And the truth is he can't do those things in this budget.
Well, he can if he makes three assumptions that very few people would consider reasonable. Assumption number one, Trump's proposed tax cuts and policy changes will spur 3% economic growth and more tax revenue.
3% growth isn't crazy, but it's very hopeful. You have to not only be good, but also lucky to get there.
Salim Firth is with the Conservative Heritage Foundation, and his assessment is generous. Larry Summers, former economic advisor to President Obama, called the growth assumption ludicrous. Trump budget assumption number two, reducing taxes by $2 trillion will not reduce government revenue. Howard Gleckman.
And the evidence is quite clear. We've tried this lots of times. And tax cuts don't pay for themselves.
And assumption number three is not really an assumption. It's just kind of an unexplained magic trick. After assuming the tax cuts will generate $2 trillion to pay for themselves, Trump's budget assumes that tax cuts will generate another $2 trillion to bring down the deficit.
But you can't do both.
Robert Bixby directs the Concord Coalition.
This budget has a roving $2 trillion that appears to be used twice. Wouldn't you like to have a roving $2 trillion?
Office of Management and Budget Director Mick Mulvaney had an explanation for where this money would come from, simplifying the tax code to reduce tax evasion.
If it's a simpler tax code, okay, that people are more likely to pay.
It's true that the U.S. government misses out on nearly $500 billion in revenue each year from unpaid taxes, but the idea that we'll just fix that is a big assumption. Maya McGinnis is president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
And since we don't have the details of their tax plan, it's impossible to analyze.
The devil is in the details, and so is the math. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
To be sure, what the White House wants in next year's budget and what Congress wants in next year's budget are not going to be the same thing. But even scaled back, even if Congress cuts some of this down, some of the cuts to the social safety net in the administration's wish list are cuts the likes of which we haven't seen in years. And as a result, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, nonprofits and advocacy groups are gearing up.
In Washington, today is budget day. Eat lunch at your desk day. Come in early, go home late day.
Well, as usual, everybody's scrambling around trying to figure out, you know, how much is proposed for what.
But usual stops there, says Steve Berg of the National Alliance to End Homelessness.
This year, there's big changes proposed to some of the large anti-poverty programs, which is not a usual thing.
Or a surprise. Trump previewed his plans in his budget blueprint in March.
We're ready for it. We know that there's a long fight ahead of us.
Samantha Vargas Poppy is with the National Council for La Raza, which focuses on issues affecting the Latino community.
So we're trying to use this as an opportunity to lift up to Congress, to our community, and frankly, anyone who will listen, what's in this budget and what those budgets mean in real life.
Something else unusual, big players like the ACLU collected record donations after the election, and they're spending it now. Faz Shakir is the ACLU's national political director.
We believe we have a responsibility to be the source of information for all these people who've come to us after the election and given us a fair amount of money. And then after that, a lot of the money will then be used on grassroots mobilization.
Mobilization of people to show up at town halls and protests or to donate more money. But Tim Delaney of the National Council of Nonprofits points out donations can only go so far.
For every national name brand organization seeing a temporary spike in giving, those are temporary. They're not sustainable.
And he says
they can never replace the amount of money that is being proposed to be slashed in this particular budget.
A budget, as you've heard, not likely to make it through Congress. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, as has been their wont the past 4 or 5 months or so, traders didn't let the news of the day slow them down at all. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I gave a nod to health care as part of the Trump economic agenda overall, but really it's worth more than just a nod. The administration wants to cut $1.6 trillion from Medicaid over the next decade. In other words, a 50% reduction in a program that primarily provides health care to low-income and people with disabilities. That's the headline number, but tucked in there as well, though, are cuts for healthcare.gov, the website that about 10 million Americans use to shop for health insurance. From the Health Desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein looks at where that might lead.
Last year, President Obama thought healthcare.gov needed $2.1 billion to run smoothly. This year, President Trump thinks it just needs $1.7 billion.
So that means 20% less funding for things including helping people enroll, running healthcare.gov, outreach and marketing, running the call center.
Aviva Arendine is a former senior advisor at Health and Human Services during the Obama administration. To Arendine, it seems odd to propose a 20% haircut when the Trump administration has already made changes that arguably call for more resources, like tightening up the enrollment period and beefing up eligibility requirements. But ultimately, she says, she's not surprised.
We've seen a consistent pattern from the administration of actively undermining the marketplaces and not doing what needs to be done to make the markets work.
One of President Trump's first moves in office was relaxing the mandate to have insurance. Then the administration pulled ads temporarily urging people to sign up for coverage. And just this week, officials pushed off a decision on subsidies, likely forcing insurers to jack up premiums. Jessica Altman, chief of staff at the Pennsylvania Insurance Department, says if these new cuts to healthcare.gov go through, it'll just make it that much harder for the 10 million people who use the site to get coverage.
It will be more difficult to navigate. There will be more hoops for consumers to jump through, or that the system won't work as well as it needs to.
Altman says everybody remembers the fiasco when the site first rolled out, giving consumers fits. The point, says Altman, is to help as many people get insured as possible, something President Trump's budget doesn't do. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The list of nationally known commuter hellscapes is short and reasonably sweet. The 405 freeway here in Los Angeles, the Beltway in Washington, the Kennedy Expressway in Chicago, Atlanta, Boston, and San Francisco have a couple as well. I apologize if I left your city off. But if you are a rail commuter, there is no place quite like Pennsylvania Station in New York City. Almost 700,000 people a day dealing with track closures, cancellations, and delays in a 50-year-old building strained well beyond capacity. And as Marketplace's Ryan Kyloth reports, after two train derailments this spring, making that piece of the national economic infrastructure better is going to mean making it worse for a while.
New York, New York. If you can't make it here, it might be because your train was delayed coming into Penn Station.
It's a crapshoot. If your train's going to be there, or you have to grab another train.
It's just like the same nonsense. It's overpacked, overheated.
It always adds hours. What are you going to do? Can't fight it.
Are you going to drive instead?
Yeah. You funny. Drive.
Don Gelestino, Shay Marie King, and Joe Peterson all commute through Penn Station. Or at least they try to.
The entire productivity of the Northeast relies on the movement of people in and out of Boston, New York, and Washington, and even further down into Florida.
Mitchell Moss directs the Transportation Policy Center at NYU.
So unless we have a functioning Penn Station, there's a severe problem for the movement of people, and this means that the economy slows down.
Moss says the underlying problem is that Penn is actually three train stations rolled into one. Amtrak, New Jersey Transit, and the Long Island Railroad all share the same tracks. This makes delays and congestion inevitable at Penn Station. Or as State Senator Todd Kaminsky calls it,
The bane of my constituents' existence.
Kaminsky represents Long Island, which sends nearly a 250,000 commuters into the station a day.
I've had constituents call me from the bathroom of trains that they're literally sitting in the bathroom because there are no seats. That's something you would hear in a different country.
According to a report from the state comptroller, delays and cancellations on the Long Island Railroad alone cost the region $60 million in lost productivity last year. Now, Amtrak, which owns and operates Penn Station, plans to close down a quarter of the tracks this summer for overdue maintenance work. Kaminsky says the timing couldn't be worse.
We on Long Island really depend on a summer economy. So to say that, hey, this summer we're going to take your trains offline could really be devastating to the Long Island economy that relies on city people coming out.
But in general, traffic dips over the summer. So while it might hurt the Long Island beach scene, a summer closure affects the fewest number of riders overall. Perhaps no one has more to lose at Penn Station, though, than Amtrak itself. Wick Moorman is president and CEO.
New York Penn Station is at the heart of the Northeast Corridor, which is the most important revenue-generating component in Amtrak. It's literally the heart of what we do from a financial standpoint.
Moorman says that because of this, Amtrak has more incentive than anyone to improve Penn Station. But others think the company's not invested enough. Recently, Governors Andrew Cuomo of New York and Chris Christie in New Jersey issued a joint letter calling for a new private operator to take over Penn Station. And Cuomo's reached out to President Trump for federal funding. Moorman says neither of those would make a difference.
The fundamental problems at Penn Station have to do with the fact that it is at or beyond capacity. Nothing changes that with a private operator.
Amtrak has both the will and the means to fix these problems, Moorman says. What it lacks is New York's most precious commodity.
Time. We just have to take the time to do this work and to get it right.
But as the complaints and the trains pile up, Amtrak may find its time is running out. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace. Coming up.
So many things could happen. All we can do is go along and just wait.
Budget realities far, far away from Washington. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 43 points today, 0.2%, 20,937. NASDAQ up 5, less than 0.1%, 6,138. The S&P 500 up 4 points, about 0.1%, 23,098. Home building companies hammered a bid on word that new home sales knocked down about 11% in April. Home building and mortgage company NVR fell 2.5%. Construction company D.R. Horton off about 1.5%. Home improvement retailer Lowe's dropped 2%. Word today that Nokia or Nokia, I'm never sure, and Apple have settled numerous legal disputes, all as part of an agreement to work together. On that news, the new companies have made this new connection. Nokia dialed up 6.4%, Apple down about 0.1% today. Check out Target. The retailers reached an $18.5 million settlement with states in the District of Columbia to resolve a probe into that massive data breach that affected about 60 million customers in 2013. That would include moi. Target discounted 1.75% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.28%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From news to numbers, you count on Marketplace to explain what you need to know. Get Marketplace delivered to your inbox every day and never miss a beat. Subscribe to the newsletter at marketplace.org.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ruzdahl. Oil closed up today, 34 cents, 51.47 a barrel. That is dollars and cents, 51.47. Continuing its general upward swing the past couple of weeks. I mentioned that by way of getting to the White House budget that came out this morning. The administration is proposing to sell off half of this country's strategic petroleum reserve and turn more than 300 million barrels of energy into $16 billion, cold hard cash, over the next 10 years. Good idea? Bad? Marketplace's Scott Tong explains the debate from the Sustainability Desk.
The administration argues a lot's changed since the U.S. began stockpiling oil in the 70s. It has. Back then, there were fears of petrostates cutting us off, so we had to store it. But in today's global oil market, that'd be pretty hard, says Fred Beach of the Energy Institute at the University of Texas, Austin.
It's easy for OPEC to say they're going to embargo you, and they can certainly do that, but that just means they're going to sell that oil to somebody else who now doesn't have to buy it from their provider, and now you can buy it from that provider.
Andy says if the U.S. suddenly needs more oil, it doesn't have to store it. It can drill it in West Texas. Another knock on the strategic reserve is it's run poorly. Energy economist and consultant Philip Verleger worked for the Ford White House when this all started. But he says the feds repeatedly have not known when to tap the stockpile or for how long. For example, a sell-off in 2011 to soften prices during the Arab Spring.
Prices went down briefly, and then the government said, that was a bad idea, we're not going to try that again. But what was really needed was a whole sequence of sales. It was just absolute bad management.
Still, the thought of no reserve is too scary for many. Oil prices can surge fast and flatten the world economy. Frank Verastro is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
We've seen a dramatic decrease in investment in larger projects, offshore projects, that bring on a lot of supply. Within the next 5 years, we're looking at a price spike.
Perhaps. And even all the drilling in West Texas, well, that can't produce enough for American drivers.
We use almost 20 million barrels of oil a day, and we produce about 9.5. So even though we sell refined products into the market, we still import a hefty amount of crude oil.
And from dicey places like Venezuela. He says it's fine to put our oil reserves on the table eventually, but you have to think it all through before raiding it like it's an ATM. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
The fact of the matter is, just to continue with the budget through line of the program today, the fact of the matter is that government spending, federal government spending, reaches into almost every corner of the American economy, especially that bit of spending listed in budget summaries as non-defense discretionary. That's the non-Pentagon stuff that Congress decides to fund or not fund every single year. The president's budget that came out this morning includes a nearly 21% cut to the Department of Agriculture. That's farm subsidies, land conservation, wastewater management. The list goes on. It's a list that'll hit rural areas hardest, especially in the West, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Goldendale is a small farm and ranching town on the high prairie of central Washington, population 3,400. It's the kind of place where a horse pulls up next to a pickup truck on Main Street. Downtown is struggling with boarded-up storefronts next to long-established shops and restaurants. Jean Morgan runs a photo gallery on Main Street. She's been here 9 years and says while the recession hit hard, the economy seems to be improving now. And what if federal agencies cut staff and spending in this rural county?
The jobs that are here have been jobs that have been here from mainly from the county and the state, and not so much money flowing in from the national coffers at all. It doesn't really affect us, I don't think.
On the outskirts of town is one of the government offices that could see cuts.
I'm Tommy Gertch. I'm the county executive director for the Goldendale Center for the Farm Service Agency.
This office administers farm subsidy, disaster relief, and conservation programs for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which the Trump budget would cut by double digits. Gertch says some of her employees are from farm families that depend on the steady income from government jobs.
One family member will have the farm, the other will work in the office and keep up on policy and keep an eye out for the family. I know they do get concerned when they hear things about the budget. So many things could happen. All we can do is go along and just wait.
About 1.5% of jobs here are federal. But in some rural counties in Oregon and Washington, the feds provide 10 to 20% of jobs, much more than in urban areas. EPA, USDA, and other federal agencies support even more jobs in state and local government.
There definitely is a higher dependence on government.
Damon Runberg is the employment economist for Central Oregon.
They've been fairly consistent employers, the local government side, so school districts and local administration, or we're looking at the federal side with Forest Service or BLM.
Runberg says budget cuts could hurt more than just rural employment.
Critical services that those workers provide, firefighting, resources to the agriculture industry, federal jobs with hydropower.
Neil Slater is a third-generation rancher in Goldendale. I caught up with him rounding up some cattle to move them to new spring pasture.
Get in there.
Now, I interviewed Slater before the election, and he was a strong Donald Trump supporter, eager for a new Republican administration to get rid of environmental regulations and bureaucrats restricting what he could do on his land. But he also praised local USDA staff for helping him get funding to drill new wells, making his ranch more profitable. And if they get downsized now?
I don't think cuts are a bad thing.
He says even if people he's known for a long time lose their jobs,
I think there'll probably be actually more benefit than adverse, because you take some of the counties where they can't log on federal lands. Counties have gone broke. You get back to managing the forest, managing the land, and you're going to see some of these revitalize and come back to life.
Back at the USDA office, Tommy Gertch says in these times when so many locals want to slash government, she keeps a low profile when introducing herself.
I might wait a little bit until I know what their feelings are. If they do have issues with the government, at least I can be there to answer questions and smooth things over.
Gertch says her supervisors in the agriculture department have contingency plans to first use early retirements and attrition rather than layoffs to deal with any potential budget cuts. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, just to completely change the subject from the federal budget. Turns out there is such a thing as too much rain in Los Angeles. We got a lot of it this winter, as I'm sure you've heard. So much the construction of the new NFL stadium being built out here for the Rams and the Chargers has fallen behind schedule, which has forced, CBS Sports is reporting, the league to move Super Bowl LV, that's 55, in 2021, from L.A. to Tampa. Maybe, just maybe, the Rams will finally be good enough to make it by then, huh? What do you think? All right, we are done on a Tuesday. The Dow up 43 points today, about 0.2%, 20,937 for the blue chips. NASDAQ up 5 points, less than 0.1%, 6,138. S&P 500 up 0.4%, 2,398. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.